Welcome to the Global Heart Podcast. I'm your host, Pablo Perel, Senior Science Advisor at the World Heart Federation. Today, we are talking about lipid guidelines and global cardiovascular prevention. Specifically, we'll be talking about two very relevant recent papers, the 2026 ACC-AHA guideline on the management of dyslipidemia, and a recent paper that we published at Global Heart entitled Global Lipid Guidelines More Aligned Than They Appear. To discuss these topics, we are delighted to have two outstanding guests. Professor Roger Blumenthal, who is director of the Johns Hopkins Cicerone Center for the Prevention of Cardiovascular Disease and a global leader in cardiovascular prevention. I'm sure our audience know him from many of his many publications, but in particular, he co-chaired the writing committee of this recent American guideline. And also we have Professor Mathieu Banach, another global leader on CVD prevention, head of the Department of Preventive Cardiology and Lipidology, Medical University of Lodz, Poland, and also president of the International Lipid Expert Panel, and one of the authors of this recent Global Heart paper I mentioned. Roger and Mathieu, very welcome. We're very happy to have you.
Thanks so much, Pablo. It's an honor to be with all of you.
Thank you very much for the invitation. Right.
I want to start with I know for you who are specialists and you know so much about this topic, it might be very simple and obvious, but I think it's important if we are talking about global cardiovascular health. What do you think are the main reasons that despite decades of evidence linking dyslipidemia with atherosclerosis cardiovascular disease, one of the areas in medicine with the strongest evidence for effective treatments in general, and ischemic heart disease being the number one cause of death globally, is such a neglected topic in global cardiovascular health?
I think there's some people in the States who feel like to give a class one recommendation that things should be done, you need multiple randomized clinical trials, and they ignore the wealth of observational data that Mathieu and others have greatly contributed to that says if you have elevated LDL cholesterol earlier in life, your risk of developing atherosclerotic disease and heart attack and stroke later in life is much higher than if you follow good lifestyle habits and have a lower set of LDL numbers as well as better lifestyle habits. So I think what we tried to do in our recent guideline was to really promote the overwhelming observational data that we have linking elevated lipids at a young age to future cardiovascular disease.
Thank you, Roger. Mathieu.
Yes, I strongly agree, obviously, with Roger. But on the other hand, please notice that it is the kind of general problem associated to the fact that lipid disorders are the most prevalent from one hand, because it is 60-70% of the patients with elevated LDL cholesterol, with the very little awareness about this, because we made a survey in Poland and some first European countries about the awareness of the LDL cholesterol level for the last 12 to 24 months. And you cannot imagine that only 8% of people know the level of LDL cholesterol. It is much lower in comparison to the blood pressure, diabetes, glucose levels, for example, obesity, smoking, and others. It is also associated to the fact that lipid disorders are probably the most silent risk factor. We, for many years, as you probably remember, and Roger knows it very well, and obviously all of you, that we talked about the blood pressure as the very silent killer, right, for cardiovascular disease. But in fact, it is these are lipid disorders, because the atherosclerosis process is an ongoing process that starts very early. And it is obviously this very individual one, but for one person, it might be 20 years until the symptoms appear. For other person, it might be 10, 15 years. So it is very difficult to convince the patients, for example, to say, okay, it is the highest time for you to start with statin therapy or lipid lowering combination therapy. And this patient is at the age of 35, 40, 45, and this patient say, okay, but I do not have any symptoms. Why you wanted me to be on treatment, right? So this is probably one of the most important issues. And this is the same also, this not adherence, this not compliance, this lack of awareness, education. associated to the fact that we have probably the largest level of therapeutic inertia. So the mistakes we are doing, right, taking into account the intensity of the treatment, taking into account the combination therapy, especially now in 2026, we have a opportunity for the first time, I guess, and this it was beautifully reflected in the guidelines led by Roger, that of the personalization of the treatment, taking into account the different drugs we have already on the market, right?
So we'll come to some of these discussions, and particularly, I think I would like at the end to come to some ways of this can be changed in terms of implementation. But I guess that at least you agree with this statement that it is a neglected topic, at least in global cardiovascular health. It's not, as you said, Maciej, maybe as high as hypertension in even in as targets and initiatives that are happening. But we'll interesting to, yeah, I think awareness and the silent nature of this lipidemia. But I think we're going to cover some of these in the discussion. Let's move then to the recent American guideline, Roger. And I know it's I mean, impossible to ask you to summarize a guideline like that. But maybe what I would like you to do is what are the main changes regarding the previous guideline? And particularly if what could be, if you think that part of our audience are maybe non-lipid specialists and even non-cardiologists, some of the key messages for that audience.
So, Pablo, thanks so much. We put a lot of emphasis on our top 10 messages, and number one was to assess risk early and treat if indicated. So, for the first time, the U.S. guidelines said we should really think about checking a lipid panel around age 10 to rule out familial hypercholesterolemia, and around age 20, and then every 5 years after that, at least. We focused in on health behavior counseling when in children and in youth, and we said that by age 30, if you still have markedly elevated LDL in the range of 160, you should give strong consideration to treatment, and you should give strong consideration to treatment if you have a strong family history of cardiovascular disease with suboptimal lipids. And then finally, with the PREVENT score, we're able to assess 30-year risk, and if you had even a 10% 30-year risk of having a heart attack or stroke, again, we should give strong consideration to really revving up the lifestyle habits and thinking about selective use of pharmacotherapy. And then we went into what's called the CPR strategy, which is C for calculate, P for personalize, and R for reclassify selectively if a coronary calcium score was ordered, and then finally to reassess. We lowered the thresholds for consideration of lipid-lowering therapy. We followed Maciej's lead in bringing back the LDL goals. We gave some guidance about when to measure apolipoprotein B, and we said lipoprotein A should be measured everyone once in a lifetime. We gave a good summary of selective use of coronary artery calcium. We emphasized high-risk primary prevention with diabetes and chronic kidney disease and HIV. And we also then also talked about hypertriglyceridemia, about how to manage that both with lifestyle and medication. So that's a good whirlwind tour for your top 10 practice takeaways, Pablo.
Thank you, Roger. And I mean, to the audience, as usual, we will put the links below the show to both papers and other important references that we will include in this discussion. One thing, Roger, and we'll come back in, later on implications, maybe in different settings about these recommendations, but more generally, you changed the title as well, no? From cholesterol guideline to dyslipidemia, and maybe you want to explain a little bit the rationale for that.
Definitely, traditionally, we'd always use the term cholesterol, but as my co-chair, Pam Myers, pointed out, we had such a greater emphasis on high triglycerides, triglyceride-rich lipoproteins, and especially lipoprotein A that we thought with our friends across the pond had always referred to it as dyslipidemia. We thought that was the appropriate thing to do. And that was one of Pam's excellent suggestions, and she had many fabulous ideas throughout the process.
And the other change that you mentioned that I think will come to Maciej later on his paper, but he highlighted is you brought the goal back to was that something straightforward in the committee to achieve that consensus?
Many clinicians, Pablo, had thought, it was reasonable in the past to have thresholds because that's the way a lot of trials had been done. But in reality, just like for blood pressure, it's easier to remember 130 over 80 or 120 over 80. And you really just have to remember three numbers, I tell my colleagues. All of us should strive for an LDL less than 100, higher risk people, LDL less than 70, and very high risk, less than 55. So having those three numbers as LDL goals, I think, makes things much simpler.
I mentioned something, and I'm sure for you and any specialist that is listening, it might sound like, I mean, maybe ignorance from my side, but I think as a non-specialist, sometimes part of the challenge is, and I know they're strong rationale. So we have the LDL cholesterol, we have the non-HDL cholesterol, we have the ApoB, we have milligrams and millimoles, we have different populations, and that is sometimes very confusing, even if I mean, if you are not someone like you, that you're only working on lipid. Do you think that that's fair to say? I mean, sometimes, I mean, and you know that you have lots of evidence behind this, why ApoB is different from LDL cholesterol or non-HDL, but don't you think that sometimes that gets in the middle of making the message, I mean, simpler?
Very good point. I think one of the things that Dr. Morris and I are most proud of is that we pretty much always talked about millimoles per liter, the European units, and whenever we mentioned milligrams per deciliter. So I think our friends across the pond will find it very easy to follow. And truthfully, we have 95 plus percent concordance with what Maciej and our other ESC colleagues have been advocating. So I think this will give lay people as well as primary care clinicians a great comfort level that, after a couple of years of really working hard on trying to update the guidelines both in Europe and the US, we really have a nearly complete agreement. And really, the only substantive difference is that, we have a different risk calculator called PREVENT that's was validated in a US population, and you all have the SCORE 2 risk calculator, and they have very similar in many respects.
Thank you, Roger. And maybe I'll move to Maciej, and I want to talk about your paper. But maybe Maciej, you have any question for Roger, and if about the American guideline, you can you have him here. I'm sure you talk with him regularly and you collaborate. But
We know each other with Roger. I guess I'm not mistaken, by 10 to 15 years at least. So we have a great contacts and collaboration. And I remember my first visit in Baltimore, so it was an amazing time for me. And thank you once again, and congratulations, obviously, to Roger, Pam, and all the authors of this amazing paper. In fact, I'm using the slides from this paper in my all the presentations since March when it was released. Because I strongly believe it is an amazing opportunity to show that something that we wanted to raise in our paper, that it is less and less inconsistency between the guidelines finally, because it was used by those people that are against the theory of cholesterol by itself. And they say, okay, so why you are promoting very low levels of LDL cholesterol if in American guidance there's a little bit different approach and they do not promote it. But I would like to, if you allow me, Pablo, to first to answer this question you ask Roger concerning this inconsistency, taking into account the non-HDL, ApoB, and so on. And this is really a great problem, especially to understand for primary care physicians, for other specialists. Because they say, okay, for many years we wanted to convince us that LDL cholesterol is the most important. Then you said that LDL and LDL cholesterol, non-HDL, because it is mass or atherogenic particles. And now you are trying to say that LDL, non-HDL, and ApoB maybe, so three targets for lipid disorders. And in fact, it is true, but it is not a kind of our expert opinion, because it is strictly based on the evidence-based medicine, right? Because we have more and more data, and based on this, we might say that if we would like to reduce residual cardiovascular disease risk related to lipid disorders, related to hypercholesterolemia, we need to not only measure LDL cholesterol, but also non-HDL and preferable ApoB. And this is something that I may say because it is going to appear in the next few weeks, promoted in the Polish guidelines. In the Polish guidelines, we have three equal risk factors, lipid risk factors, so LDL, non-HDL, and ApoB. And this is the same with the calculation, because in most of the guidelines, as Roger said, we try to use both units in order to be consistent, right? But on the other hand, I always a little bit argue and a little bit smile to my colleagues from European Society of Cardiology, European Atherosclerosis Society, because, for example, if you have a 100 milligrams per deciliter, for some it is 2.5, for others it is 2.6. So it is a little bit difference, but there is still, and it might cause a little bit inconsistency between the, for example, primary care physicians. So what is the real target, 2.5 or 2.6? But if you would like to ask me about the lipoprotein line, it is even more complicated because we shouldn't calculate nanomole per liter to milligrams per deciliter, but we do it due to the fact that we use different tests. And for example, at the very beginning, we had 50 milligrams per deciliter, so it means 125 nanomole per liter. And immediately, suddenly, within the European guidelines, we had 105. And it was only due to the fact that it was based on the Copenhagen study, when all the patients had the same test used for the lipoprotein level and the measurement. And that is why such a calculation was done, which in my opinion is not correct, because we still, for example, in Poland, we use at least 4 to 5 tests. So this is something that we always need to take into account and try to make this message as easy as possible, because then we also are at the risk that someone may not understand it well, right?
Yeah, I think as many areas in cardiology, sometimes I don't know if it's a call it a problem, but part of the issue is that there's so much knowledge. And I think your intention with the paper you wrote for Global Heart, Maciej, that it was really nice and very well received, was to give some clear messages. So maybe can you tell us first why did you decide to write that paper? And what are the kind of key messages from that paper that you've recently published?
So first of all, we prepared this paper because we wanted to see to show to everyone that we are very close to say that we are on the same side, taking into account the diagnosis and treatment for lipid disorders, and there is the same message, for example, associated with LDL cholesterol. So the lower, the better for longer, preferably the lifetime, and the earlier on the LDL cholesterol goal, the better. So that is why this is critically important. Then another message that we are very close to have the same way for the risk stratification. So first of all, to stratify the risk optimally using not only different algorithms, because there are obviously some differences between SCORE2, SCORE2P, and PREVENT algorithm, but also we have the imaging methods we are using in our everyday clinical practice concerning CCTA calcium score, which is very useful in order to be very optimal with the risk stratification. And the issues associated with the approach to the lifestyle changes in order to support, let's say, the therapy, when to start therapy, and how to be effective in order to prevent the first event. So not only to be effective after the event and how to be effective with lipid disorders, but not only typically what Roger emphasized at the very beginning of his talk on the hypercholesterolemia, but also hypertriglyceridemia, which is a critically important residual cardiovascular risk factor, which is I'm not so sure why was missed in the European guidelines, because if you see the risk modifiers from the ESCAS guidelines, there is taking into account the biomarkers, there is hsCRP, lipoprotein(a), there is no triglycerides anymore, and I'm strongly against this approach, taking into account the knowledge we have, taking into account the particles that are ongoing, and obviously the treatment, because as I said, irrespective of the place we are living, we have a beautiful approach to the personalized treatment with statins, fixed dose combination with ezetimibe. Mostly, most of the countries, we have a possibility of using bempedoic acid, PCSK9 inhibitors, inclisiran. And we are awaiting obicetrapib and oral PCSK9 and many other different drugs. So it is a beautiful moment to say we can be effective with the true with diagnosis and treatment of lipid disorders.
So, Maciej, what would you say, maybe in summary, what are the key things that guidelines agree and I think where we can focus?
I would prefer to say what are the key points that there is still some small differences between the guidelines, because it is, I believe, more important taking into account the discussion and the great honor having Roger on this meeting, right? Because if we look at the there is still difference taking into account how we stratify the risk. Because I would love to have a PREVENT in Europe to start as early as possible. So because we have more and more patients at the risk at the age of 30, 25. 35, for which we would like to stratify the risk, and not only for 10 years perspective, as we have for in the SCORE2 diabetes, but also for 30 and maybe lifetime perspective, something we are in favor to do. So, because you cannot imagine it, every day I have patients at the age of 45, and his/her risk is, for example, 2.5 for 10 years. And so the message for the patients is that for next 10 years, and the chance that the person will not have any event will be 97.5%. So the person asked me, if I have a no chance to have any event for 97.5%, so why you wanted me to use statin therapy by the end of my life, right? So what is the reason? But having the lifetime risk approach and risk estimation and showing the same risk at the age of 80 or 70 and showing that this risk now is 2.5, but the age of 70 might be 25 or 30, it is much easier to motivate this person. Please start as early as possible, because now you can really prevent something that may happen in next 20, 30 years.
But Maciej, and you correct me if, again, I'm trying to oversimplify things, but again, going to the things that you put in your paper that there is some agreement, is a early identification of high risk and a lifetime approach and the cumulative approach. I think that's kind of having a goal is also something that, and then early getting intensive treatment for those at high risk and the use of combination therapy in general is there is consensus on those issues.
Yeah, it is a firm one thing that having Roger I can ask. It is that, for example, in the European guidelines, something I promote very much for last 5 years, it is upfront, so early lipid-lowering combination therapy. We introduced when the International Lipid Expert Panel in April 2021 for the first time and said, okay, that for patients after ACS, for patients with extremely high or very high cardiovascular disease risk, even pre-event, let's start immediately with the statin and ezetimibe as upfront lipid-lowering combination therapy to be on the target as early as possible to stabilize the plaque. And it was even covered in the US ACS guidelines, so it to be class of recommendation, but it is not covered within the US lipid guidelines. But I am sure that Roger have a great response for it, because it is still a matter of discussion, obviously, but I strongly believe it is a kind of gold standard we should follow.
I think it will be interesting to talk about that and hear to Roger about combination therapy. One other thing that I, again, for the audience, and I think I'm being fair that, I mean, really, this is a short paper by Maciej and his collaborator that is really nice and has a really useful table where it compares how guidelines address different things. And I really recommend, we cannot cover all of that. But another thing that I didn't mention is the role of Lp(a) as at least once in life to have a measurement. I think that's also there is some consensus. But anyway, going back to you, Roger, on combination therapy, what do you think about it? And maybe respond to his comment.
I think many of us feel like if we, in our higher risk patients, if we can't get to an LDL of 50 just with the starting dose of the statin, then we certainly start off with ezetimibe plus the high intensity statin, and certainly in favor of that. I think Maciej and I have written in the past about this therapeutic inertia, and if you start early with ezetimibe plus a high intensity statin, you're much more likely to get down to the levels of LDL that are associated with stabilization and possibly some modest regression. So many people are interested once they get diagnosed with coronary heart disease to say, what can we do to reverse this or stabilize it or at least get some partial reversal? And one of the few things that we have at our disposal is much more aggressive risk factor reduction, both from a blood pressure and cholesterol standpoint. So certainly fine with that. The one on the other hand, some people would say is sometimes, in the US, we don't have that combination of rosuvastatin, ezetimibe, or atorvastatin, ezetimibe, which I think is available in many parts of Europe. If we did have that combination rather than having to give two separate pills, I think, clinicians would, might just start there. And hopefully, one of our pharmaceutical colleagues will in the States will come up with that and we'll be able to start endorsing that much earlier. But I certainly agree that lower for longer is better, and we need to get that message out. And I use the same comparison to people who fear a hip fracture. I say, if I was an endocrinologist and trying to assess what your risk is of a hip fracture, what would I do? I'd get a bone density scan. Well, that can help us determine who's really at high risk of a hip fracture. And when we're in the fence about what to do, we said a coronary artery calcium scan might be the best tiebreaker. So there's a lot of parallels in that, but have the utmost respect for what Maciej has contributed to the field, and he's been ahead of his time for many years.
Thank you. And I think I'm particularly interested in combination therapy at WHF. Also, we've been working on different documents on combination therapy for hypertension and for combining. And I think it's an area, it's interesting. I mean, it's, I don't think it's easy because, I mean, there's part of the industry. I mean, you need to have the drugs available. Also, in terms of regulation, many times they want to have hard outcomes that for many of the things. I mean, that's a question for you, Maciej. Do you think we need, I mean, new trials showing hard outcomes for combination therapy, or we have enough evidence to move into implementation? And is that one of the reasons why they're not included in guidelines?
Yeah, definitely. I strongly believe that it is one of the reasons that, for example, in ESC/EAS guidelines, we have a 2A class of recommendation for patients after ACS, right, for using early combination of statin and ezetimibe during the index hospitalization patients after ACS. But it was mostly based on the data we have had so far from meta-analysis, from real-world evidences, and there is no randomized controlled trials, but not pre-specified randomized controlled trials. Because if you look at the data we have, in fact, IMPROVE-IT was an upfront lipid-lowering combination therapy of simvastatin and ezetimibe. If you look at the PRECISE-IVUS, it was statin and ezetimibe. If you look at the RACING trial, which was negative in the end, taking into account the cardiovascular outcomes, but it was positive, taking into account the key secondary outcomes, it was the upfront lipid-lowering combination. That is why in March 2025, we published the largest ever meta-analysis comparing randomized controlled trials. It was 14 trials with 110,000 patients included, comparing the upfront lipid-lowering combination therapy of moderate to high-intensity statin therapy plus ezetimibe versus high-intensity statin therapy as a reference. And we showed that it is associated with further reduction of LDL cholesterol, more chances to be on the target. And first of all, significant reduction by 12 to 14% of the MACE, stroke, and all-cause mortality. So it is something, as Roger said, that it is something that we all know that it is a great benefit for the patients. But answering your questions, I am in favor that I do not need new randomized controlled trials to confirm it, because I strongly believe that having the data from those studies, those randomized controlled trials that we have had so far, and believing in the results of the data from the CTT collaboration showing that 1 mmol per liter of LDL cholesterol for statin and non-statin therapy is associated with 20-25% reduction of cardiovascular outcomes, I do not need a concrete randomized controlled trials to say, okay, what is better, high-intensity statin therapy versus moderate to high plus ezetimibe, because I strongly believe that we have enough data for it. But obviously, I know many of my colleagues that are very restrictive taking into account this approach. Even I can tell you it is a kind of, I treat it as a kind of joke, because I have many colleagues in Europe that I do not use rosuvastatin after ACS, because if you notice, there is no randomized controlled trial pure randomized controlled trial with rosuvastatin in patients after ACS. So they do not believe that it is so easy to explore the results from atorvastatin in other studies. So for me, this is a kind of a little bit how to say a little bit joke, because we need to be very careful how we look at the evidence base and how we read it. And because in the end, there is a patient, right, as an end user of it, and we need to do our best in order to be effective. So I do not need new data, and I know it very well that it will be the same, because Roger knows about it perfectly, that we are expecting the statin, ezetimibe, and bempedoic acid as a triple fixed-dose combination in Europe that is going to appear. We know it very well that there are trials with oral PCSK9 with rosuvastatin with ezetimibe as a fixed-dose combination. And I strongly believe, and I hope that, and I keep my fingers crossed, that the fixed-dose combination will be a part of the treatment, not only in US, because it is something that is very much expected, I believe, but also in UK, because in UK there is also a problem with fixed-dose combinations with of lipid drugs, right?
I think, single pill combinations, that's part of, we've been, as I said, we've been working a small thing, but in terms of terminology, and this is what some people argue, that they avoid call it fixed dose, because part of the problem and resistance of physicians is to say, because it's fixed dose, I cannot change if I need to do anything. So, but it's happening everywhere. People, because of the success we have in the cardiovascular field, we have a lot of evidence-based treatments. And if you have different cardiovascular conditions, you require many, many, many pills. And it's, I think it's a way forward. And it's for me, it's moving into maybe the next question I wanted to ask you, that is implementation. And part of this is, you mentioned already, inertia, and starting with a combination therapy and to more aggressively, can be part of overcoming some of that barriers. But what are the other key implementation barriers that you think are there? You mentioned already a few, but maybe you want to summarize again. What do you think are the main barriers for implementation of the guidelines?
Maybe I'll start off, Pablo. So I think there's still resistance, as Maciej was saying, about do we really need to use medication early when a person's 5 or 10 year risk appears so low? But we actually lowered the threshold for intermediate risk to down to a 5% risk of a heart attack or stroke over the ensuing 10 years, and we said, especially if there's risk enhancers present, like a family history, you could give consideration even as low as 3%. And truthfully, if you had a high 30-year risk, you could also qualify or have a family history. So I think what we want to try to get across to the skeptics is it's not just giving them medication, but it's trying to focus in on strategies that can improve their lifestyle. And we want to motivate people to optimize their dietary and exercise habits. We want to brainstorm with them. And maybe it's going to be a 4 month period, a 6 month period, maybe it'll be a 12 month period. But our patients need to realize that if they're still pretty far away from a minimal target, in our case of 100 milligrams per deciliter, which would be 2.6 millimoles per liter, then they ought to give strong consideration to going on medicine while we continue at each and every visit to work on lifestyle. I think, the critics say we're just, giving too many people, pushing too many pills. But in reality, what we're trying to do is to use this as a teachable moment, give them some, assessment of what their risk is, personalize things with looking at other risk enhancers, maybe South Asian descent, maybe Filipino, maybe persistently high triglycerides. And I think we want to get people to realize that about 80% of all cardiovascular disease is preventable, but we need to start early and we need to motivate people earlier. Be curious what Maciej's thoughts are.
Okay, so as I strongly agree. Obviously, it is not a surprise that I agree with Roger, because these are the words that probably everyone would agree. But there are a few things, because Roger mentioned something critically important about the risk enhancer. It is something that we are very much focused in last several years, few to several years, because we know it very well that when we use the different score algorithms, irrespective of whether this is prevent or score two, that within this algorithm we are opportunity only to see the few parameters we are checking, right? So for most of our patients, we might have underestimation of the risk and in the consequence, the under treatment. That is quite normal because we would like to have those risks used in all of the countries. So they cannot be biomarkers involved in this risk categories that are not available in the given countries. But on the other hand, using risk modifiers or risk enhancers, these are critically important because if you have a, it is based on the European guidelines. If you have a, at least one risk enhancer, risk modifier, you can increase the risk category by one. But if you have a three or more, if the patients are the low to moderate risk, these patients should be always treated as a at least high cardiovascular disease risk. And these are family history, obesity, hypertriglyceridemia, it is hsCRP, lipoprotein(a), it is endometriosis, it is cancer, and many, many others that we might consider as the risk factors. And this might help really that those patients will be well stratified and well treated, taking into account the intensity. It is one thing. Another point, which is maybe less observed in U.S., but it is very much observed in Europe, it is country-to-country differences, taking into account the drug availability and the possibility of good diagnosis of and the early diagnosis, because it is associated with the differences in the healthcare system, simply. So from one hand, obviously, we are talking very much extensively recently about the CCTA, about the calcium score, but you can imagine that in many countries it is not available at all, right? So in Bosnia and Herzegovina, Albania, and other countries on the Central Eastern European region. On the other hand, drug availability. I just had a beautiful study that we submitted to American Heart Association about the triple therapy of statin, ezetimibe, and bempedoic acid in patients treated after acute coronary syndrome from India. And I asked the question, okay, but where are the PCSK9 inhibitors or inclisiran? They are not available in India, right? It is the same when we discuss, you, Pablo, are from Argentina, but and Raul is from Brazil, and I had many discussions with Raul concerning the PCSK9 inhibitors availability that are available mostly commercially in Brazil, right? They are not available within the drug program, within the reimbursement we have. So this is something that we always should take into account when we are talking about the also efficacy. And obviously, those issues you've mentioned, Pablo, such as education, ongoing education at any level, it is critically important. So not only by specialists, but also by primary care physicians, by nurses, by physician advisors, and so on. So at any level that this education should be, and obviously lifestyle changes that Roger beautifully mentioned. Without this, we will simply fail, right? Because we will have more and more patients on treatment. And without this, without education about the lifestyle changes, it will be something that we all often observe. So people believe that when they use PCSK9 inhibitors, or when they use GLP-1 receptor agonists, there is no common sense in order to be on diet. There is no common sense in order to have a regular exercises. So that is why it is so critically important to remember and to talk about.
Thank you. And yeah, I mean, you cover, I mean, a lot of issues that are key on implementation of many guidelines, but from education, awareness, I mean, this kind of changing paradigm about overall risk and availability and affordability. But I want to ask you specifically in low resource settings, and I'm talking, for example, in thinking sub-Saharan Africa and places where one thing that is very limited is if we look at the example of hypertension or other conditions, I mean, like HIV, the one way that they succeeded was to shift the management towards the communities, and they have task sharing. The blood pressure can be measured very simply by non-physicians. What's the role of point of care for measuring? I know, I mean, is that an area that is promising? I know, I think in the WHO essential diagnostic devices, the only point of care that is included is total cholesterol. So there is no point of care for LDL or ApoB. I mean, do they have any role? Do you think that a model could be measuring with point of care at the community level and has some role of task sharing for managing dyslipidemia?
Pablo, maybe I'll start. So, we've always been a big fan of non-HDL cholesterol. If indeed point of care testing could have both a total cholesterol and an HDL. I think that would be so much better. We know that the target, the equivalent target for non-HDL is 30 points higher than the LDL target. And especially in women, non-HDL is a better predictor of outcomes than than plain LDL is. So I think in some of the health fairs that we've been participated in here in the US, we've always tried to arrange that people get a total and an HDL cholesterol. And I think that could fit in very nicely with, especially in the lower socioeconomic settings or lower income countries.
Yes, I agree, obviously. But Pablo, you've mentioned a really great point, because if you would like to be effective, we need to have the process of prevention and diagnosis very much extended, and all the groups of experts within the system should be involved. That is why, for example, in Europe and Poland and Central European countries, we are not only focusing on the primary care physicians, not only for specialists, but also, for example, on dietitians or pharmacists, right? And because for many years, at least in Europe, in Central European countries I represent, pharmacists were considered to be simply people working in a kind of shop, right? So they're without any other possibilities of being part of the system. Now, for the last 10, several years, 10, maybe 10 years at least, they are part of the system, and they took part in the measuring of the blood pressure, for example, you've mentioned. They take part in the vaccination process, right? And there is no problem in order to also to include them in the process of the measuring of the other risk factors, including lipid disorders, BMI, and smoking cessation and consultation, so on. So that is why, if we are really able to create the system when all steps of the system will be effectively used, I strongly believe we will be successful with the early diagnosis of the cardiovascular diseases and this successful treatment.
I think, as usual, I think for every question, I feel like I could do a podcast with the two of you, and hopefully we will continue this. And Raul Santos, who is the editor in chief, he's an expert on lipids, and I'm sure we will be following and publishing a lot on. And you mentioned about him earlier on, Maciej. But I want to finish at least this conversation today. And I'll ask you two final questions. The first one is, let's say that you are talking with the Ministry of Health, Maciej, and I'm sure you do. And you don't have much time. I mean, you are on, and you have like 2 minutes to tell him what you think they need to do. Maybe, I mean, it's easier for you to say maybe in Poland, and I'll ask you, Roger, to think about what would you say. So what should be, I mean, the priorities?
So I think in the US, we really want to emphasize to our leadership that 80% of cardiovascular disease is preventable. We need to stress the importance of better lifestyle habits during childhood and adolescence and young adults. We have to let people know that a lifetime of having a healthier diet and better exercise habits will markedly lower certain types of cancer, but especially cardiovascular disease. And that we have some very evidence-based goals to try to get the LDL or non-HDL cholesterol down. And we need to emphasize that. And people don't need to think that cardiovascular diseases can be in something that's predetermined. We really have it in our power to use medications selectively for blood pressure and cholesterol. And I go back to what Maciej and I have talked about in a long time, the ABCs of prevention. A is assessment of risk. A also stands for selective use of aspirin or anticoagulants. B for blood pressure, less than 130 over 80 and preferably less than 120 over 80. We have great guidelines now for C cholesterol, and C also stands for cigarette cessation. Then you have D for diet and weight and diabetes prevention, and E for exercise. So if the clinician can voice that to our patients, they can realize things that for their general health, there's things that they can control, and especially the lifestyle habits. And we want to work as a partner with them. The shared decision making is really vital, and we give Neil Stone so much credit for that because he emphasized that way back in the 2013 cholesterol guideline.
Thank you, Roger. So your chance, Maciej, to talk with your Minister of Health.
Yeah, so it is quite a funny question because especially I was in the Polish government for 2 years, about 15 years ago. So I also had a chance to see the other side of the of this game, let's say, important game, because it is in fact the life of our patients. So the main issue is that we are trying for last decades to convince the Minister of Health and the Prime Minister and the Minister of Finance, because it is always the issue of the money, right? To put more attention on prevention, because I don't know if you can realize that in most of the countries, including Poland, the percentage of the ratio of money dedicated from National Health Fund for prevention is only 2%. So we always try to convince the politicians to have at least 10%. So in order not to focus only on the regenerative medicine, so only people with the disease, with cancer, with established atherosclerotic disease, after stroke, with obesity, and so on, but how to prevent. It is something that beautifully works done in 1990s by in Slovenia, as you know very well, because it is a beautiful coordinated comprehensive program in patients in primary prevention. And in fact, it is something that, because one thing that it is to discussion, but on the other hand, we have been able to do a lot of great things. Because first of all, I don't know if you know that we have a My Health program since May 2025. So My Health program is a regular checkups for all the patients 20 plus. So it is every individual at the age of 20 plus can have a regular checkup, so the different biomarkers for free, and to have a consultation and the other steps if the results are outside the normal values. We have, for example, the beautiful program My Health in the primary and comprehensive school, how to educate about the health, about the vaccination, about the lipid disorders, risk factors, and so on, about the lifestyle changes. We have, for example, comprehensive coordinated care of patients after acute coronary syndrome, amazing program introduced in 2017, and many, many others. But the problem is, in comparison to my great friends from Western countries, that we do not communicate it well. So that is why sometimes when I'm on the different meetings in Geneva and in Brussels and so on, when I present what we have been able to achieve in Poland, they say, "Oh my goodness, we didn't know about it, that you are able, that you have been able to do so many things." So that is why also I have told you at the beginning, Pablo, we established European Program for Prevention to tell about it, to collaborate, to exchange experience, and so on. So yeah, more focus on prevention, I believe, especially now having the Safe Hearts plan by the European Union, is something that we should in fact scream, not only to talk loudly, but to scream, right?
Yeah, I was going to say that Safe Hearts in Europe is definitely a good opportunity. And also for WHF, I mean, that's awareness, communication, advocacy. I think this is part of our mission and definitely, I think, a huge area that, to develop in terms of this epidemia. To finish, we always ask our guests to share very briefly what you understand by global cardiovascular research. So in your own words, I mean, what do you think does it mean?
So Pablo, I think the where the field is going in global research is really in better ways to implement what we know. Here in the US, we just had the publication of what's called the CKM guideline, cardiovascular, kidney, metabolic, and was led by two of my close friends, Chiadi Ndumile and Fatima Rodriguez. And what they emphasize is that, when people start gaining weight, they develop cardiometabolic syndrome, maybe develop liver fat, kidney disease, liver disease, cardiovascular disease are all connected. And we need to do a much better job of educating the public that, especially when they're younger, you don't want to go around and continue to gain weight each year and to be lackluster with your physical activity routine. So I think that CKM framework, in addition to the prevention message that Maciej and others in Europe have been advocating for years, is just so important, both from a lifestyle standpoint. And now we finally have some medications that can help us with this epidemic of obesity. So I'm looking forward in my mind to implementation of what we do know, and to try to help motivate people to improve their lifestyle habits at each and every medical visit.
Yeah, for me, global cardiovascular research is equal to collaboration. It is something that we are doing together, right? So, because I am probably the one of the many examples you can see, Pablo, you are probably another one, Roger, and many other our colleagues. Raul Santos is an amazing example of it, that whenever we are, we can collaborate on these critical subject of the cardiovascular diagnosis and prevention and treatment. And that is why from the very beginning, I couldn't have imagined that that I can work only in Poland and in the region, because it is always an amazing opportunity to go to the Western countries, to the US, to Australia, to see how the system works, how looks like the diagnosis process looks like, and the treatment, what we can do in order to be better, what we can do within the exchange of knowledge, collaboration, joint grants, and so joint papers, and so on. So for me, global cardiovascular research is a meaning, it is a call of collaboration. And this is the only way in order to be successful against cardiovascular burden, and we know it very well, taking into account the global burden of disease, another amazing issue of collaboration worldwide, that it is 19.2 million deaths attributed to the cardiovascular disease. And only working together, also within the World Heart Federation, we might be successful against this threat and this one number one killer in the world.
That sounds really, nice and aligned with, our mission. Also in Global Heart, implementing what we know and collaboration across, in different geographies and disciplines. So, Roger and Maciej, thank you very much again. This has been a really, really interesting discussion.
I totally enjoyed it, Pablo and Maciej.
Thank you very much. It was an honor. Thank you. Thank you so much.
To our listeners, we will put the two papers, 2026 American Dyslipidemia Guideline and the Global Heart paper, we'll put in our show notes below the podcast. Remember, please subscribe wherever you listen, and thank you as always for joining us on the Global Heart podcast. Bye for now.